Hi, I'm Umushu.
And I'm Lindsay Claiborne, and you're listening to Beyond the Microscope.
Hi everyone, welcome back to Beyond the Microscope. This is Lindsay and Mumu. We are here with our friend Morgana Carter. She is a senior information analyst at the American Speech Language Hearing Association, or I think in short, it's ASHA. Morgana, thanks a lot for being on the show. And I will start off with a very hard-hitting question. What do you do?
Oh gosh, what do I do? Well, in the short of it, I just try to make data interesting for other people. And I try to tease out really good stories from data that's already existing and paint a picture with that information. So that's very idealistic, very wishy-washy. So what do I do on a day-to-day basis? A lot of what I do involves working with, I'm in the healthcare industry and specifically for a healthcare association. So we work a lot on pulling out information for healthcare practitioners to get information about trends in the industry, trends on patient information, and try to provide as much satisfaction as we can with the data we have to help healthcare practitioners, therefore help the general public with general healthcare issues. That's a lot of health, but that is what I do.
How did you get there?
It was a long, winding road. When I was growing up, I had no idea that this field even existed, right? I had no clue that data science was something, that data analytics was something you could do. For me, you know, I knew I liked politics and I knew I liked policy. And naturally, the right course for you to go when you know that is to go onto Wall Street, which is what I did. Made no sense at the time why I chose it as my first career path, but I did. And then from there, I moved into actually doing political data, where I fell in love with analytics. And at the time when I joined that specific profession, it was really getting its sea legs off the ground. You know, I think the evolution of data in policy and the evolution of data in politics over the past 10 to 15 years has just been tremendous.
Or in anything. I mean, take the journalism reporting. I mean, I know in my field, not to interrupt you too much, but like
that, go ahead.
That like data journalism is now its whole thing instead of just being part of like normal everyday reporting. I mean, I would say that the boom probably goes along right with that.
Well, and I think the quality of data journalism, like you see like the Times, you know, and the Tribune, they have such good data analytics. And I think they're really leading the field in some of the data visualizations that you see out there. There are like wizards who know Tableau and D3 and all these really cool JavaScript tricks.
Were you a numbers person?
You know, I wasn't. I was an arguing person, and I was
I love it.
And the talking person. And I really do believe that so much of data is about actually talking about it. You know, I think, yes, I look at numbers more than the average person, but none of that matters if I can't explain my numbers to somebody, and none of it matters if I can't use that information to convey a specific point to someone.
This is sort of going a little bit non-linear in your story, but we were, you know, Lindsay and you were sort of mentioning how sort of data analytics and data visualization is sort of this booming thing right now, and I guess statistics is having its heyday in the media.
Oh yeah, but you can't call it statistics.
Well, this is the thing. Scary. It's like to me, and actually to a lot of technical people, this just seems a little bit like, and no offense meant for it, but it seems a little bit like glorified statistics, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
There's aside from the visualization aspects, which we don't really know, which is sort of like this new thing, there isn't much new stuff that's out there in terms of the actual math behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you sort of, like, what do you account for this boom in data analytics?
Ooh, yeah, that is a good question. I think what we're seeing more and more of is, you know, like everyone goes with their guts for most of the time, right? You know, it's like, oh, licking my finger, seeing where the wind goes, right? And that led us to a lot of recessions. You know, you could really go back to the, depending on how far you want to go back, you know, like you can go back to the 70s and look at it. But I think after each recession, I think there's a new trend or something new that people come to believe in after some sort of economic dip, that this will be our saving grace and this will help us and this will help businesses and this will help our profits. So, you know, I think you can make the same case for like social media, right? You know, like, is this really novel? I've been on AOL Instant Messenger since what, 1995, 1994? I mean, are we really revolutionizing all of this? And what value is my actual social media profile? I mean, what are we really getting out of this? I think with nonprofits and associations where I am currently, I think what's really been useful for this sudden boom, or what's really been driving it, is that I think technology has gotten cheaper and more accessible. And that's a lot to look at and to explain, because it's not just the technology itself, you know, buying the actual product, but also training people. I think the cost for training has gone down. And, you know, if you're at an association and you don't have that much staff and you don't have that much resource, or, you know, that many resources to invest in it, then, you know, having the lower cost to entry and the lower training, you know, barrier associated with that, I think helps. I think basically just tech and analytics have gotten more user friendly. And, you know, not to say that it's gotten more, that it's gotten easier. I actually think what makes it more challenging now is that because everyone has access to it, it's how do you cut through all the clutter and what actually makes sense and what is actually statistically significant without, you know, enrolling someone in a stats class. So,
well, right, because we now have, like, everyone has access to all these numbers to things. And used to be that nobody really found these numbers, or you had to go and request them and physically pick up a piece of paper and then crunch the numbers yourself. So now that anybody can run, like, their own simple pie chart or something.
Mm-hmm. Oh, pie charts.
Yeah, well, that's why I knew you would react to that. So, but, you know, that it's that to make an effective image or representation, right, of data that isn't just, you know, 50% yes and 50% no, but is actually something that tells you more than what the average person can just queue up on Google.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And one of the things that I've been working on in my current position is, and I have to be careful here because there is some sensitivity around it, just because it's healthcare. But basically, one of the things that came out of ACA, which is the Affordable Care Act, is the idea that healthcare should be more user-driven. And by that, basically, the idea is, like, let's say you are a 30-something male in Texas, and you want to find a doctor who treats your condition. In theory, we have all the data and all the information to be able to go and search for a doctor in your location who treats your condition. And you can see how well that doctor treated somebody with your specific condition. Now, that gets into a whole other realm, and it touches a little bit on what you were just saying, of how do you measure outcomes, right? Like, how do you actually measure how well somebody got treated? And that's a tricky thing to do in healthcare, because what if you started off very severe and you only moved up to average or moderately severe? You know, that is that more or less successful than someone who came in as an average issue or at an average symptom or problem and moved up to outstanding or excellent, or all your symptoms were relieved?
Right, and it's not it's not linear, right? I mean, everybody's
exactly,
different
yeah.
levels of things, yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, I will say, I do think there are some unique measurements that are being created. I think there's, with that, always some challenges. You know, how do you standardize that across different professions within the healthcare industry? How do you compare that? Are these right? You know, is that really the metric that we should be looking at? Is that what patients want? Is that what it means to be patient-driven healthcare? Yeah, a lot has changed, and I think more is going to change in the field of medicine and healthcare as more provisions get put in place and more research is applied.
Well, since we're on healthcare, I have this dream that I'm going to, like, in 5-10 years, I'm going to be able to implant, like, a little chip in my wrist, and my doctor's going to be able to know when I have, like, blood pressure issues, know if I have diabetes, know if I have, like, cholesterol problems, and all I have to do is check in every once in a while, and you know, all this information will be across the board. I can go to 3 different doctors in 3 different countries, and they'll all be able to find the same information and won't give me the wrong medication.
Ugh. The dream.
Right? The dream. But that also, I think you probably are feel, you probably have in your gut the nightmare of, like, how do you handle all of that information and not, you know, set us all up for identity theft? I mean, are you, what, right. what's your thought
yeah,
on
no,
all
it's,
that?
It's huge. It's a huge issue. And people, oh gosh, that's going to be such a big issue that we grapple with. So if anyone is really interested in data security, get in contact with me, because this is going to be such a big issue we continue to grapple with. And I think, so I think there's a couple ways to look at that. The first and probably the most cheeky, and I'm going to use cheeky because I just came back from London.
excellent word choice.
This idea of, like, commercial products coming in. Like, for example, your Fitbit, your Apple Watch, something like that, which is supposed to track all your information for you. You know, what if a third party stored all that information for you? So it could say, oh, Lindsay, we've been tracking your heart rate for the past 2 weeks, and we noticed the spike, and we're automatically setting up an alert for you. Right. Yeah. Almost like, what were those commercials when we were
Life
younger?
Alert. Life
Thank
Alert.
Thank you.
I'm falling and I can't get up.
Lindsay, you have not had a pulse for 2 weeks. Are you okay?
Are you dead? You are? Excellent. Oh.
Discharging battery. But, like, obviously, there have been some issues with even the Apple Watch itself. I personally do not have one. If you do have one, I would actually love to hear your experience. I don't know if Mumu, if you have one or Lindsay.
No, but
one.
If anybody's listening who has
wants
money
to give
and
us
like
one,
to donate
yeah,
Apple Watches,
we'll take them.
We are more than happy to take them.
Kickstarter. but I mean, I think, you know, there are some obvious issues around that. Like, one of the most obvious ones I think I just read was that the Apple Watch has issues if you have a dark pigmented tattoo.
Oh yeah, I
it
saw
has
that one.
Issues with that. Certain apps that you turn on, the battery gets drained faster, you need to be by a GPS to track all your running, all this stuff, right? So that's a little bit tricky. So then what comes out of, let's say, your doctor's office or your specialist office is holding all of your data information. So doctors have a lot of paper records, and I think if anyone's been to the doctor in the past year or 18 months, you've probably have seen a push for a lot of doctors, to do more digital information. There's a risk associated to that. I think most doctors are so busy and so dedicated, you know, working on their craft and actually helping patients that the question is, well, when will they find the time to put in the data, right? That's a big issue of, when does the data go in? If it's after a 12-hour or 16-hour or 24-hour rotation, are you really going to tell someone you have to stay an extra 2 hours to put in the data? That brings up issues of data fatigue, which we all know when you're tired and you're trying to do data, what that ends up looking like.
Numbers.
Terrible, right? I mean, what happens if your doctor does a misstroke, you know, while typing and you're, you know, heart rate numbers go from like 79 to 99 over 120, you know, that's a difference. So that's a whole issue, just general human error and who has access to that information. And then the question about transmitting that information, right? So there's a whole lot of, you know, encrypting you can do, SSHS, you know, a lot of secure server information in the works. One thing that I really appreciate that my organization does is that we try to take that as much as possible off the doctor's shoulders so that, you know, if they want to participate in certain programs, provided we have access to their data, we can handle a lot of that information for them. But it's not an easy solution. It's actually, you know, I wish I had the magic bullet, and I think whoever finds that will make millions of dollars. But until then, it's a tricky situation. You know, in the UK, they had, or they have universal healthcare, and where this information is readily available for doctors and for practitioners alike. There have been data breaches. I think the most recent high profile one was in like 2012 or 2013. And I think it was, thankfully, if I'm remembering this correctly, it was less about like your social security number and personal information. And more about, oh, this patient had this issue, but they couldn't match it to a specific person. So how do you deal with that information to, you know, keep personal matching information separate from the actual diagnosing information and all that good stuff?
Well, just as a side note, I understand the data breaches that might happen at, you know, stores like Target for the sort of for a recent story where people steal credit card numbers or social security numbers. Why would someone steal someone's medical record?
Well, one situation that we worked with, or one wireframe that we were working with when we were building out one of our programs to address some of the healthcare initiatives, was the idea of privacy in the sense of your personal identity. You know, I live in a large city, and I'm probably not the only female between the ages of 25 and 30 in my city who goes to a specific doctor. But what if you live in a small town, right? And you're a very specific demographic in that small town, and someone's able to pinpoint who you are and what specific condition you have. If that information is readily available, it opens you up to a whole host of issues. Like, what if your employer is able to figure that out? That, oh, Sally Smith in small town USA has been going to see this therapist for the past 4 years. And she started out at this level of assessment. And in her 4 years, now she's only at this level. Ooh, should we hire her? Should we not hire her? You know, that level of privacy and making sure that, you know, it goes back to sample size, right? How big is your sample size and how large are you going to report on your sample size? So that's one issue. What is your N size that we're looking at here? But also with your medical records beyond that, you know, a lot of people will do phishing scams on that information. It's one, usually very current information, your personal basic information that you give your doctor with your email address, your phone, your address. Typically, we don't give our doctors our fake Yahoo or Hotmail accounts to get our personal information. So most of the time, people recognize that data information for your healthcare records are very up to date. Also, it goes a little bit back to infrastructure. I think healthcare is one of the fields which, you know, unlike, say, Wells Fargo or banking institutions, which have these massive security structures built out. If you think about healthcare, it's really up to the individual practitioner of how they handle their information. You know, there's no like Wells Fargo of dermatologists who are handling all the claims and all the information of every single dermatology doctor in the United States. Some practices may have better data handling skills than others. Which make them an easy target. And I think you do see a lot of phishing scams and a lot of just scammers just, you know, blanket hacking and blanket trying to brute force their way into medical records because they may perceive healthcare records as easier to access for some of that vital personal information.
With regards to, I think I actually asked this question to Cass when we were chatting with her in an earlier episode. But with regards to sort of the targeting that you do and the models that you create, is there any analysis of the information that you get afterwards? So like, how correct are you and how can you tell if your targeting is effective?
I will try not to rant about the second part. So when I get to that, I think when you are looking to target, I think like everything, there's just finite resources and finite constraints, right? So you have to look at your budget of what you can do with that. You have to look at who's movable and who is already set. And from there, start to build out what your universe looks like. I think with straight up political targeting, you know, I think, not to rehash what other guests have said, but you can start to build out who your predictive voters are, who your persuasive voters are. It changes for every election based on the candidates, based on you know, what's big in the news, where your reach is, if it's a statewide, if it's a national election, and how many people are honestly likely to be moved. It doesn't make sense to go after a small group of people, which can max net you 2,000 voters, and you have a voting, you know, a vote deficit of 200,000, right? So always trying to convey that and always trying to understand that information. I think when you're building the models, again, it depends. Some campaigns and some candidates have a lot of money, and so they can do a lot of great things with that money and build and target more individuals. And, you know, I think the question of how accurate is the targeting? I have a lot of thoughts on this. And the basic answer, I think, is that everyone, regardless of whether it's political or healthcare or Internet of Things or wearables or business or financial, whatever you're analyzing, I think we as professionals can do much, much more in the field and in the specification of looking at our results and being honest and saying if we were right or wrong. I think it's something that we as professionals just don't do enough of. And I think part of that is partly ego. No one likes to admit that they're wrong. They don't actually teach you how do you do that in school. How do you say that you're wrong? And you cost the company, you know, $500,000. That is a hard thing to admit. And that's a hard thing to swallow. What would be great if more people did was constantly A/B testing and constantly making those small adjustments and incremental changes throughout your campaign. And I don't just mean political campaign. I mean even a business campaign that you're running. You should not just be checking your results at the end. It should be a continual process of getting feedback and getting information. So when you finally write your report or when you're finally looking back to see how well your targeting did, it's not, oh, we wasted this much money. It's, we noticed something was wrong. We made these corrections and we found them to be successful, or they yielded us X amount.
So can you tell us a little bit about the projects that you're doing now?
I love my projects. Sure. So I actually, and just to clarify, I do some coding in my job, but the majority of my coding I do on the side, just as a hobbyist and enthusiast. So a couple that I'm working on, probably the biggest, which I really need to wrap up, but programming projects just never finish when you expect them to, and they always grow and always evolve. But I'm working on one, this program for Major League Baseball. I'm not hired by them. I'm just using their information. But basically, it was inspired by the movie Ferris Bueller, where you...
Okay. I was waiting for you to, like, say inspired by Moneyball or something that would make logical sense. But okay, go for it.
Not at all. It's that feeling you get when you wake up and you're like, I want to do something fun with my day. What can I do? And you don't really want to spend too much effort figuring it out. You kind of just want to be like, yep, that's good. I don't like that option. Let me pick that option and have a total schedule built around for you to have fun. That's the point of this app. So right now it's mainly focused on the baseball part. As you might recall, anyone who saw the movie, Ferris on his day off goes to a baseball game. And it's this great part of the story. So basically what it does is that with some information given by the person using the app, it looks up if there's a game for you that day. And if so, what time is the game? What time do you need to leave your house to get to the game? If you want to build out a whole day around the ball game, say you want to get a lunch, you can then start to specify, well, I'm going to bring my kids, so I want it to be a family-friendly lunch under $35, or this is a romantic date for two, which... we should change your expectation of what's romantic, but if that's what you want to do, it will then filter information and provide you with restaurants nearby the stadium that are very romantic, offer to make reservations for you on OpenTable. And if there's not a game in town, it will either offer you the option of listening to the radio affiliate, shout out to radio. And so you can listen directly at home if you want to. Or if there's a nearby team that's playing, it will offer you the same benefits of getting up to that team. And, you know, how do you need to get up to them, to that other team, et cetera, et cetera. This is only scalable right now to large metro areas. So I'm working on finishing up the DC one so I can then move it to New York City, which has multiple baseball teams, Chicago, which has multiple baseball teams.
If, let's say, the tickets are sold out for your game, does it also provide an alternative to watch it somewhere, like at a sports bar, for instance?
I should really like put that making in there. Notes. That's a good idea. Yeah, no, that is a great, isn't that, that's the best part about programming. Like, you talk to someone and you're like, oh, that is something I want to put in my app. That is a great idea. Look out for version 3.
Well, while you're at it, all you need is to integrate with Fox Sports because they've got a lot of the games on and you have their Fox Sports to go feature.
Boom.
Get them to pay for it for you.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
This is synergy right here.
So that's one. I'm also working on, I'm really excited about this one, actually. So fashion is great. Fashion has a lot of social issues on it and ethical issues on it, which is a whole other thing to discuss one day about where we're sourcing our clothing from. But this app doesn't deal with that yet. I'm trying to figure out how to integrate it. But basically what I am looking at, a lot of great sites put up some of the fashion collections for each designer as images that you can look at. And so what I'm doing is I'm basically going through and looking at all those, you know, captured photos from the runway and from the different fashion lines, and not only trying to analyze what each collection is doing for that season, but also see if there are some general overall trends, right, for the entire season. So you could be like, oh, well, Marc Jacobs really likes zebra printed stuff this season, but the overall trend is, you know, polka dots, blue polka dots, and that's what we're going to go with. This does not help anyone's life in any particular way, but I think it's really fun because I think one other trend, which we keep coming back to, is this idea of us becoming really embracing this idea of visualization and visualizing things, right? Like, we have so much information and stuff on Pinterest, on Instagram, you know, like even Facebook. Remember when you were allowed to upload photos? That was a big deal. But we as human beings and our storytelling, the image and the photo is such a big part of that. It's data does not always come to you through numbers. A lot of times you have to look for data in other ways. And I am using this project as a way to explore what information can we glean and cultivate and capture from actual images. So it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun just to go through that information. I'm weirdly running into like technical issues of like data sizes and memory issues and all that good stuff. But I'm really enjoying that project. Yeah.
Not to be a downer, but why do you do these things? I mean, like, you just, is this like your hobby, or is it, are you plan, do you have like this secondary motive to, besides learning how to fix these things and how to do things? Like, obviously you're saying you're running into data issues or like, you know, and that's a puzzle for you to solve. I mean, but do you have like grand plans of making the next, you know, app and selling it to someone, or is it just
or am I that pathetic?
I'm just curious, like, because I mean, look, Mumu and I are doing this podcast, so I don't know what we're thinking.
I love
either,
it. I love it.
It's for the money.
Hey, my paid in jelly beans.
Help me. Yeah, so I think for me, and I am guilty of this too, is I heard this great quote, and I'm going to source the quote. So there's this fabulous person I know, Alia Rahman. She's really big in the DC data scene and does a lot of community organizing. But what she said was a quote which has stuck with me, is that Silicon Valley is a bunch of really big minds working on really small problems, which is very powerful and very true, right? Yeah. Like, you have these great minds working on the next dating app. You have all these people working on, you know, like the next wearable, which doesn't actually connect to your healthcare provider. You have this mind working on fashion prediction, which is not actually helping the source of the issue of how clothing is being made and the ethical treatment surrounding sweatshops and things like that, right? Like, there are actual issues that we aren't working to solve. And that doesn't totally answer your question, but I mean, I am just doing this right now, honestly, for fun, in the hopes that as I'm doing this stuff, you know, I have all these questions that keep coming up for me. Like, you know, even with this fashion one, one of the things I even said was it doesn't address some of the big issues. I would love a way to figure out a way to tie in these big issues. And my hope is that by doing some of these projects,
you can not only do that out.
Exactly. Yeah. And figure out some way to start to tackle this, you know, and I think we only solve ideas by, you know, we stumble across them. And I'll use Uber as the great example. I don't think when Uber was created, they realized they created this app or this program that would somehow solve in urban communities the whole issue of Black men not being able to hail cabs. I don't think that's what, I mean,
Uber that wasn't on their agenda.
Yeah. But shockingly came up with this amazing product in some ways that solved this issue. And we can, again, there's a whole other issue about its labor and what it's doing to businesses.
Yeah,
but,
right.
You know, for that social issue, it had a positive. Like, Twitter, I don't think they realized when they created Twitter that, like, a third of its user group would be, like, Black people under the age of 35. You know, I don't think they realized they were creating this whole ecosystem for a specific group to talk. So I'm hopeful one day I'll stumble across one of these, you know, being mindful as I'm building this information out and that I'm trying to look out for the different social angles. Hopefully we'll be able to pivot onto something that can then expand and change and positively benefit society.
No, I mean, that's cool. I was curious because, you know, I didn't know whether you had, like, you know, grand startup plans or whether it was like Mumu and I doing this because Mumu felt the need to do this and has been griping about it for years, and I finally made her do it. So, like, you
I
know,
love it.
I'm not trying to, like, diminish it. I think it's really great.
It's cool.
I was curious as to what, like, was the motivating factor behind it.
Yeah, because it is really, I make fun of myself about this because, like, really, you don't have better hobbies than this, Brianna? like, this is what you spend your weeknights doing? Okay. But if anyone wants to hire me to work with them on these issues, feel free to reach out to me. I'd love to talk to you.
My email is.
Yeah, seriously. Come at me. I mean, and I would eventually, you know, I think all these life experiences that I'm having, even professionally, you know, starting out in for-profit, working my way through the political world, going into nonprofit and association world and all this background. I think the inevitable conclusion of all this is that I will run my own company one day. I'm very comfortable with that. But until then, yeah, I'm just exploring and learning and just seeing what I can glean from it. And if it helps one person, awesome.
Anyway, that's all the questions that we have, Morgana. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys.
For coming on to our show. And we really appreciate it.
Yay. Thank you guys.
Like our show? Find out more at scopepodcast.com and follow us online on Facebook and Twitter at Scope Podcast. This is Lindsay Claiborne
and Mumu Shu.
Our theme music was composed by The Copycuts. Thanks for listening!